With the latest agriculture news from across the state and nation, it's time for the AgNet News Hour from AgNet West. Here's your host, Danielle Leal.
Hey everyone, Danielle Leal here, and thanks for getting your agriculture news with me today. Federal lands plan could limit grazing public uses. Ranchers, foresters, and others who use public lands have urged the Bureau of Land Management to withdraw a proposed rule they fear would radically restrict activities such as grazing and timber harvesting. The new BLM proposal emphasizes conservation as the predominant land management priority. Those who hold permits on federal land also say they were blindsided by the proposal. A coalition including the California Farm Bureau said BLM defines conservation so broadly that it creates unnecessary conflict among users of public lands. That was today's California Farm Bureau Food and Farm News Report. And now let's get into today's show headlines. Animal Ag Alliance releases an extremism report. The Animal Agriculture Alliance released reports detailing the interconnectedness of the animal rights movement and their tactics targeting animal agriculture. Abby Cornegay, AAA's Manager of Issues and Engagement, says, quote, "No matter the animal rights extremist group or the tactics used, they all share the same goal of eliminating animal agriculture and taking meat, dairy, poultry, eggs, and seafood off grocery store shelves and family tables." Almost one-third of all animal rights extremist attacks documented in 2022 targeted farmers and food workers, putting them and the animals in danger. Some of their documented actions against Animal Ag include 95 vandalism incidents, 70 stolen animals, 60 criminal trespasses, 10 arson cases, and 9 harassments and intimidation incidents. Cornegay adds, quote, "Extremists are getting ever bolder in their efforts against animal agriculture, and direct actions at the farm, processing facility, and retail store continue rising. If you'd like to find out more information about proactive security measures, you can visit animalagalliance.org. And AFB contributed to that report. And now here's AgNet West Brian German with more agriculture news.
CDFA's Alternative Manure Management Program is still accepting grant applications from dairy producers. Community education specialist with UCANR's Climate Smart Agriculture Program, Amber Butland, said they can help producers with the application process and can also provide other technical assistance with the implementation of grant projects.
If there are any dairy producers right now that are interested in the Climate Smart practices that are being funded through the AMP program as another grant that we support. And the application is currently open. So if there are any dairy folks out there, it's something to consider. And I would suggest maybe touching base with the local dairy advisor who then can, you know, reach out to us and we can work in conjunction with them on the projects. They're also similar to SWEEP. It's a pretty involved application process.
The new Luna UCR avocado variety presents a new opportunity for growers. Professor of Extension and Subtropical Horticulture, Mary Lou Arpaia, said the new variety has attributes that growers have been showing great interest in, including having the ability to perform well in high-density planting situations.
And the Hass variety is not very adapted to a high-density planting here in California because the tree tends to be quite large and spreading. So the Lamb Hass variety and the Gem variety are more compact trees. And you can easily plant more trees per acre of those two varieties without having to do a lot of pruning. You still have to prune, but you don't. So the nice thing about Luna UCR is that it is a very upright, slender tree. And so it is already adapted to a high-density planting setting. So that's the third positive thing about this variety.
I'm Brian German for AgNet West Radio Network.
Thanks, Brian, and stay tuned as we'll have more of the day's agriculture news and farm features here on the AgNet News Hour. Don't forget, if you've missed any of our morning shows or if you simply need to catch the news at a different time, you can always subscribe to our podcast and have statewide agriculture news at your convenience. All you have to do is search our name of AgNet West on your favorite podcast downloading app. That's AgNet West. It's available on both Apple and Android devices.
Why do you listen?
I just want to stay informed while I'm on the go.
News on the radio, it's nice because it's just a quick snippet and I don't have to go searching for it or grab a paper.
I listen to radio because anywhere that I'm going, I'm listening to music or I'm listening to a talk show or I'm just trying to stay up on current events.
I always turn into the radio to see if I need to take shelter, where it's hitting, to see what I need to be preparing for.
Why do you listen? Go to whyilisten.com, tell us why you listen, and you have a chance to win $500. Visit whyilisten.com today.
Welcome back to the AgNet News Hour by AgNet West. I'm your host, Danielle Leal, tossing it right on over to Sabrina Halverson with today's National Spotlight.
In today's National Spotlight, Arkansas Senator John Bozeman, ranking member of the Senate Ag Committee, traveled to Indiana last week with Senators Mike Braun and Todd Young to hear from producers and talk about the upcoming farm bill. Crop insurance and labor issues were two consistent themes throughout the day, as was the Supreme Court's ruling on California's Prop 12.
As we've looked at converting our individual sow stalls to group housing, the numbers that we've seen are going to be somewhere in between $3,000 to $4,000 per sow that it would cost to retrofit our facilities.
Indiana pork producer David Hardin shared with the senators that if he were to make the investment to become Prop 12 compliant, it would take him somewhere in the neighborhood of 10 years to recoup that investment. And there are no guarantees that another state won't move the goalposts on him again. Bozeman understands Hardin's frustrations.
This is a terrible decision. And then also it's a terrible precedent, not only for what's happened to pork, but other industries too. You know, if you wind up having multiple states when you're trying to produce a product, it makes it really, really difficult.
American pork producers are hopeful that a legislative fix can happen that could overturn Prop 12. Some were hopeful that the legislative fix could happen in the farm bill. Both Braun and Bozeman dashed any hopes of that happening.
The problem is with this administration, they're very much like the California administration. I don't see President Biden signing a bill that overrules them. So it's a difficult situation. We're going to be working with our various groups like Farm Bureau and the pork producers and all of those things to see if we can figure out a path forward.
Back in May, the Supreme Court upheld California's Prop 12, which is a ballot measure that prohibits the sale of pork, eggs, and veal not produced according to the state's production standards. Transportation leaders from the U.S. and Canada held a virtual news conference Friday to talk about maritime shipping in the Great Lakes region and its importance to both nations. The U.S. Transportation Secretary Pete Buttigieg was joined by Honorable Omar Alhabra, Minister of Transport for the Government of Canada. Secretary Buttigieg.
We're in the midst of making the most comprehensive infrastructure investments since Eisenhower was in the Oval Office, building new foundations for the American economy, large and small, and once again, showing how democracies can deliver. And that includes more than $82 million in grants to U.S. Great Lakes ports to help improve current throughput capacity and to prepare for future growth that we know is coming in order to keep goods moving and keep shipping prices down.
His Canadian counterpart talked about environmental initiatives.
To cite just one example, we have jointly announced our commitment to helping establish a green shipping corridors network in the Great Lakes St. Lawrence Seaway system, which, by the way, has been talked about at our recent G7 transportation ministers meeting in Japan. This initiative underscores our shared goal of reducing pollution and promoting sustainable practices along the seaway and in the marine shipping sector. In line with this commitment, our government has developed a National Green Shipping Corridors framework. This framework will help guide the marine sector involved in the development of green shipping corridors, with the aim of reducing environmental impacts and ensuring Canada's marine sector remains competitive in the global market. Just this past April, the Green Shipping Corridor Network Collaborative Forum brought together government officials and industry stakeholders from both our countries to discuss green shipping in the Great Lakes.
That's today's National Spotlight. I'm Sabrina Halverson for AgNet West.
Thanks, Sabrina. And now for today's livestock report, here's Randall Wiseman.
Well, in today's livestock news, steer prices are rising higher than expected this year, but will they cool off in 2024? Gary Crawford has a story that helps to answer that very question.
For about 2 years now, drought conditions and high feed costs have been prompting cattle producers to send more animals to feedlots than normal, sooner than normal, and of course,
keep pulling those cattle forward for so long, and eventually your current supplies tighten up. And we're certainly starting to see that as we look ahead into 2024.
USDA Outlook Board Chairman Mark Chekanowski says it's already starting to happen with cattle inventories shrinking.
So the beef production for next year is forecast at 24.7 billion pounds. That would be down almost 2.5 billion from this year.
Or a decline of 9%. Predictable results of that. Steer prices this year already strengthening.
And expected to continue to strengthen into next year.
Mark's Outlook Board of forecasting this year's average steer price an already strong $175 a hundredweight. Next year's price well over $183, up almost 5% from this year. Gary Crawford for the U.S. Department of Agriculture.
Thanks, Gary. And USDA Outlook Chairman Mark Jekinowski has the latest forecast for this year's beef production.
For our 2023 production forecast, we raised it by 70 million pounds. Currently forecast at 27.16 billion pounds of beef production. And the increase this month kind of reflects a continuation of an ongoing pattern of pulling more cattle into feedlots, reflecting poor forage availability. And we're also seeing higher cow slaughter as well. So higher marketings, higher cow slaughter, offset to some degree by lighter weights, but still resulting in greater production this month relative to what we had been forecasting.
Again, that was USDA Outlook Chairman Mark Jekinowski. Well, Cargill recently partnered with Trees Consulting to develop a new gold standard approved methodology, giving beef producers a way to measure methane emission reductions. The methodology uses feed supplements incorporated into beef cattle diets. The new methodology defines a set of parameters that beef producers can adopt to quantify reductions of methane emissions, a greenhouse gas derived from the digestion process in cattle, as well as manure handling. It's now available for beef producers to quantify, audit, and verify methane reductions. To learn more about this, you can go to Cargill's Feeding Intelligence website. And the National Pork Producers Council recently submitted testimony for the Congressional Record on the importance of trade to the U.S. pork industry. It all took place at a field hearing in Minnesota to discuss trade in America. In their testimony, NPPC said free and fair trade has helped the U.S. become an economic powerhouse, but to maintain that position, the country must expand trade in existing markets and open new markets, and it must resolve issues, including with supply chains that could negatively affect the ability to trade. I'm Randall Wiseman for Agnet West.
This is the Agnet News Hour by Agnet West. I'm your host, Daniel Leal. We'll be back in just a moment with more of the day's national headlines and local reports when we return. But don't forget, if you've missed any of our morning shows or if you simply need to catch the news at a different time, you can always subscribe to our podcast and have statewide agriculture news at your convenience. All you have to do is search Agnet News Hour or Agnet West on your favorite podcast downloading app. That's Agnet News Hour. It's available on both Apple and Android devices.
You're going to need me.
You're going to need us.
All of us.
You're going to need our help with your water, your air, your food.
You're going to need our determination, our compassion.
You're going to need the next generation of leaders to face the challenges the future will bring.
And we promise we'll be there when you need us.
Today, 4-H is growing the next generation of leaders. Support us at 4-H.org.
You've been listening to the Agnet News Hour by Agnet West. I'm your host, Danielle Leal. Welcome back. We've got more of the day's agriculture news right now.
Instead of Christmas in July, how about Thanksgiving in July? That's coming up on This Land of Ours. Forecasts for turkey production are up and price forecasts are down. Gary Crawford has this report.
I've noticed a number of radio stations and TV channels are doing Christmas in July programming, so I decided to try Thanksgiving in July, taking a look at that July favorite, turkey. And according to the latest Agriculture Department forecast, it looks like supplies of this festive fowl will be larger than expected both this year and next. The USDA's Outlook Board chairman is Mark Jekinowski. He says turkey producers are boosting production this year. They will likely do it again next year.
With these higher supplies, prices have actually been trending a bit lower.
In fact, USDA just lopped more than 4 cents off of its 2023 wholesale price forecast, now at almost $1.64 a pound. And for 2024, prices could average a little bit less than that, making it easier for grocery stores to run specials on turkey for the holidays. And Mary, what am I saying? This is Gary Crawford reporting for the U.S. Department of Agriculture.
And I'm Sabrina Halverson for AgNet West.
This is the Agricultural Law and Tax Report. I'm Roger McCowan. The essence of forming a contract is offer and acceptance, and an acceptance can be in any form that objectively shows your intent to accept the offer. But is an emoji sent by text message enough to accept a contract? An enforceable contract requires that there be a clear offer and an acceptance of that offer. In a recent Canada case, a grain terminal sent a text message to farmers offering to buy flax for $17 per bushel upon harvest later in the fall. The elevator then followed up by phone conversations with a farmer. Based on the conversations, the elevator executed a written contract that their representative signed in ink. The elevator texted a photo of the contract to the farmer, and he replied with a text of a thumbs-up emoji. When time came for delivery, the market price of flax had risen to $41 per bushel. The farmer refused to deliver, claiming that his thumbs-up emoji text was only an indication that he had received the text photo of the contract, not that he accepted it. The court disagreed. Based on the farmer's past practice of accepting contract offers by text message and that digital acceptance is the same as pen and ink, there was a deal. The result would have been the same in the U.S. In addition, in the U.S., all it takes for a grain contract to be formed is any form of confirmation as to the core contract terms. This has been the Agricultural Law and Tax Report. I'm Roger McCowan.
We now have the ag trade numbers, the complete ag trade numbers for the first 8 months of this fiscal year, October through May. And in that trade update,
a lot of negative numbers.
USDA economist and trade tracker Bart Kenner says U.S. ag exports for October through May totaled just over $128.5 billion, 5% below the same time frame a year ago. What's behind the decline?
It's the big downturn in bulk products that is the biggest mover of the total export value.
Bulk product sales down 8% from a year ago.
Exports of wheat for October through May were $4.5 billion, down 4% from the same time last year. Corn exports were $9.8 billion, down 30%. And cotton exports were $4.6 billion, down 20% from last year.
Soybean export values still 8% ahead of a year ago. Volumes down 1%, but again, total U.S. ag exports to the world down 5%. However, sales to one big customer are continuing to stay above a year ago.
Exports to China October through May are $28.6 billion, up 2% over last year.
And Bart Kenter says that's despite a huge 37% negative movement in Chinese purchases of U.S. corn.
There's a lot of other products in the positive making up for that.
And here are just a few. First, by value, China has bought 24% more U.S. soybeans than a year ago. But there's more.
Pork exports to China are up 39% over last year. Dairy products are up 13%.
And within the dairy category,
cheese up 29%.
China has cut back on purchases of some U.S. products, down 14% in beef, 22% in poultry.
Also down 100% in horse meat.
Horse meat, he's not kidding. China consumes from 170 to 220,000 tons of horse meat each year. But again, total U.S. ag exports to China still ahead of a year ago. Gary Crawford reporting for the U.S. Department of Agriculture.
This is the AgNet News Hour by AgNet West. I'm your host, Danielle Leal. We'll be back in just a moment with more of the day's national headlines and local reports when we return. But don't forget, if you've missed any of our morning shows or if you simply need to catch the news at a different time, you can always subscribe to our podcast and have statewide agriculture news at your convenience. All you have to do is search AgNet News Hour or AgNet West on your favorite podcast downloading app. That's AgNet News Hour. It's available on both Apple and Android devices.
GMOs? Genetically engineered? Bioengineered? What's what? Well, GMO stands for genetically modified organism. It's the common term many people use for foods created through a process scientists call genetic engineering. And you'll start seeing bioengineered on some food packages to let you know the product or some of its ingredients come from GMOs. Feed your mind with more GMO knowledge on FDA's website.
Welcome back to the AgNet News Hour by AgNet West, providing you with statewide agriculture news daily.
I'm your host, Danielle Leal. Now let's listen in to more featured segments.
Considering the run-up we have seen in the grain trade, this correction tells us buyers are in a little better position than sellers. I'm Mark Oppold with the Bottom Line Report to begin the last full week of July, brought to you by Helena Agri. Even though there may be more erosion in the trade, we think Crop Scouts measuring fields this week will give us an indication of yield loss for corn and early yield potential for soybeans. Bottom line, we see corn, soybean, and wheat higher at the end of this week from where we start. This is the Bottom Line Report. Helena asks, what's in your tank? Helena's technology is proven to help fungicides and insecticides work harder. Visit HelenaAgri.com to enhance your tank mix. The Spring Wheat Tour and Federal Reserve Board meeting in July headline major events this week. Wall Street stretch of higher closes the longest since August of 2017. And looking at that Fed meeting, still about a 70% chance, according to Wall Street analysts, that the Fed will raise interest rates a quarter point, but perhaps the last increase for this year. That's our bottom line to start the week. I'm Mark Oppold, wishing you a profitable day and a profitable week ahead.
Just like elite athletes, dairy cows are fed a specialized diet to ensure they stay healthy and reach their potential. Many farmers rely on cattle nutritionists to strike a precise balance between feed rations and milk output. Technology is improving the process for everyone, says Megan Taylor, a nutritionist from Kentucky.
It's so wonderful for our industry to adapt and learn and utilize new technology. The more information I can get about the animal, about the feed that we're feeding, about how they're processing the feed, about the milk that's being produced, all those things make my job easier at the end of the day.
Megan speculates that dairy operations of all types and sizes need to adapt and rely on technology, especially in the next 5 to 10 years. Among the clients she works with is Western Kentucky University, which houses the Smart Holstein Lab, a collaborative effort between the university and Holstein Association USA.
Being able to be part of that and to kind of watch how the technology will unfold and how it's going to get utilized by more and more farms, it's a really neat thing to have here in Kentucky.
Like everything in farm management, there's no one-size-fits-all. WKU's Smart Holstein Lab is where companies determine which types of operations are best suited for their products.
Some of them are just very rural and may not have any Wi-Fi connectivity. And I mean, that's just a small example, but they're just all over the place. There's a broad spectrum. So all these different companies and devices are really, it's awesome to be aware of them and to see how we can utilize them at different farms.
Precision technology can be used in registered Holstein operations to make strides in milk production, improve reproductive outcomes, be more efficient with feed consumption, and more. Megan says this is the best part of her job as a dairy nutritionist.
What I enjoy most is definitely moving the mark. You know, the producer and I will set goals and kind of set a benchmark of where we want to be, and then we'll try to move that mark. And that is extremely rewarding for both myself and the farm.
For Holstein Association USA, I'm Bob Cervera.
Cotton ending stocks are set to increase. More after this. The USDA cotton projections for August through July indicate that global cotton ending stocks will increase by 570,000 bales to 94.5 million bales. That's the second highest level since the 2014-2015 crop year. As production exceeds mill use for a second year in a row, world cotton prices are forecast lower than the $1.01 per pound estimated for 2022-2023 and the recent high in 2021-2022 of almost $1.32 per pound. Although the world harvested area is projected to increase 2% or 600,000 hectares, a projected decrease in the global yield reduces the production estimate year over year. Global cotton production is forecasted to decrease by 1.1 million bales, or 1%, from 2022-2023 to 116.8 million bales in 2023-2024. I'm Sabrina Halverson for AgNet West.
at food stores like this one across the country last month, something happened that could be very significant, but most of us food shoppers probably didn't pick up on it. It was such a small thing. But it is good news for food shoppers, and it's reported in the Labor Department's latest Consumer Price Index report, the CPI, which says that grocery store food prices in June actually dropped from May by a tiny amount, 0.1%, yes, but a drop nonetheless. And in fact,
we've seen food at home prices drop in two of the past 4 months.
A 0.2% decline in March, and now a 0.1% drop during June. This from Agriculture Department economist Megan Schweitzer. She says prices dropped in June for half of all of the food commodities that the Agriculture Department tracks. And this cooling of inflation, it's not just in the food arena.
Well, we're really starting to see prices come down across categories, across the economy, with that all item CPI down to 3%. We're just really seeing a slowing in both food and non-food categories across the economy here as we come out of that period of really high growth in the first 6 or 7 months of last year.
But we don't want you to get the wrong idea. Grocery store food prices are still averaging as a whole 4.7% higher than a year ago. But that is a lot better than the over 11% increase we saw on average for 2022. But even so, we shoppers last month were paying more than we did in June a year ago for things like cereal and bakery products. Those prices are almost 9% higher than June a year ago. Sugar and sweets costing 11% more than a year ago, with smaller hikes for beef, fresh fruits and fresh vegetables, and non-alcoholic beverages. Those beverages, they are up an average of over 7.5%. But now on the other side of the price picture,
a few categories have experienced actual price declines over the year. So not just that the growth has been slowing, but that prices are lower than they were a year ago. And those are eggs, which are 7.9% lower than last year. Pork is 3.8% lower than last year. And fish and seafood prices are 0.9% lower than last year.
Oh, and of interest to me, milk is averaging about 2% lower than a year ago. This is Gary Crawford reporting for the U.S. Department of Agriculture.
This is the AgNet News Hour by AgNet West. I'm your host, Danielle Leal. We'll be back in just a moment with more of the day's national headlines and local reports when we return. But don't forget, if you've missed any of our morning shows or if you simply need to catch the news at a different time, you can always subscribe to our podcast and have statewide agriculture news at your convenience. All you have to do is search AgNet News Hour or AgNet West on your favorite podcast downloading app. That's AgNet News Hour. It's available on both Apple and Android devices.
We want everyone to breathe clean, healthy air, but California's traffic and mountains don't make it easy. Our mountains trap pollution, making us more vulnerable to dirty air. Today's farmers are voluntarily doing their part with help from USDA's Natural Resources Conservation Service. How? By replacing older diesel-powered tractors and equipment, treating dusty farm roads, avoiding open burning, and more. Can't afford it? NRCS has invested $178 million helping California farmers clean our air. They can help you too. NRCS, helping people help the land since 1935.
Welcome back to the AgNet News Hour. I'm your host, Danielle Leal. We have another episode from the Vineyard Team's podcast talking all about RNA-based vaccinations for grapevine viruses. Show host Craig McMillan talks with Yin-Win Kuo, an assistant project scientist at the Department of Plant Pathology at the University of California, Davis.
Our guest today is Yin-Win Kuo, and she is an assistant professor in the Department of Plant Pathology at UC Davis. I'm Craig McMillan, your host, and I'm very excited to have Dr. Kuo here with us today. Welcome.
Thank you for having me.
So you've been doing some interesting work, the lab, on interference RNA and also how it affects plant viruses and possibly insects in the future. Can you explain for those of us that did not take genetics like we were supposed to in college what interference RNA is and how it works?
Sure. So RNA interference is a biological process in which certain types of RNAs can trigger RNA interference. And then once it's triggered, it will produce specific small RNAs that can regulate gene expression by degrading or binding to the target RNAs containing a homologous sequence, containing a similar sequence of those small RNAs. So this is a general concept of RNA interference. We also call it RNAi. It's very complicated, the whole process, and there are different pathways and mechanisms included in the RNA interference. RNAi is a primary and effective antiviral defense in plants, but also found in some fungi and insects and lower eukaryotes. And because of all these different mechanisms, scientists and researchers, they work on different aspects of this mechanism for either plants or animals. And they're also looking for different potential and better ways to use RNAi for different applications.
So if I understand correctly, you have a cell and there is DNA in that cell, and there's genes that code for certain things. And so the RNA is what's transmitting or is carrying information from that's encoded with the gene out into the world to do something. Is that a fair explanation?
So the genome there in plants or animals and human is their DNA. Genomes is DNA. And then the DNA was transcribed into RNA, and those RNA, some of the messenger RNAs can translate into proteins. So it's how the central dogmas of from DNA make RNA, and then RNA make protein. In the old days, we thought that, oh, the protein is the important things, because the protein can have different functions and different ways to regulate everything in the body or in the different organisms. But then afterwards, we found that actually RNAs, they have many different forms, and they can function at the RNA level. So it can interfere with gene expressions and many different things.
And how does this apply to plant viruses? So you've done some really exciting work with Gemini viruses, I believe, with grapevine virus A. Tell me a little bit about that work and how that works.
A lot of plant viruses, they are RNA viruses. A lot of those devastating viruses in grapevines, for example, the grapevine leaf roll associated virus or grapevine red blotch virus. So grapevine leaf roll associated virus is an RNA virus, and grapevine red blotch is a DNA virus. So there are different types of viruses. And so my work is trying to use different viruses, making them into viral vectors to induce RNAi in grapevine plants to target those important viruses causing diseases in the field for the grapevines. And because, so for example, when the viruses, they are infecting plants, they will trigger RNAi in the plant so that plants can protect themselves from virus infection. And because of that, we're trying to develop viral vectors can trigger RNA interference to target those viruses that's causing diseases. The work I have on the grapevine Gemini virus A, the GGVA, is I develop the virus into viral vectors to target RNA virus first. So that's the initial plan for us, to use GGVA, the grapevine Gemini virus A, to target grapevine leaf roll associated viruses. So before we eventually target that virus, we have to do a lot of different tests. We need to know if the clones, the constructs, the DNA constructs we have of this GGVA can actually infect grapevine plants. So we have to do that. And then we want to see if we can develop it into viral vector to carry the sequence we want them to express in grapevines to do the work we want them to do. So then we use it to target genes in the plants to see if it can silence the genes in the plants. So then we did that. We found that, yes, we can use that viral vector to silence genes in plants. And then now we try to see that if we can use this viral vector to target other RNA viruses, other grapevine RNA viruses, because we are actually at the same time developing different viral vectors. And one of them is GVA, it's grapevine virus A. I know the name, it can be very confusing. GGVA is a DNA virus. GVA is an RNA virus, totally different two viruses. So since we have both viruses in the lab, so first we try to prove the concept. We use the GGVA, the DNA virus, to target the GVA wild-type virus to see if we can see any effects on the GVA infection, the viral titers in the infected grapevines. So this is what we're working on right now. And so eventually we want to use this viral vector and potentially other viral vectors too to target grapevine leaf roll associated virus. And maybe we can use it to target mealybugs too.
How are these vectors introduced to the plant?
We modify from the previous reports how people try to deliver those constructs, the plasmids, into grapevines. Most of the experiments or the assays from before, they needed to have grapevine plants grown from in vitro on media or from the embryos. But that's really a lot of work, and it'll be harder to have applications in the field. So then we develop a vacuum infiltration method that we can directly vacuum infiltrate those plasmids, that those DNA construct plasmids, directly into the greenhouse grown grapevine plants. So those plants are propagated from the cuttings. And then those plants, they are usually maybe 12 to 19 inches high above the soil when we infiltrated those plasmids into those grapevine plants. So this is, and we got pretty good results. We successfully introduced those DNA constructs into the grapevine plants, and those constructs can be infectious and initiate the virus replicate in the grapevine.
So is this something that can be done in a nursery then with new plants, and basically they then would come with the vector, or is this something you could do in the field?
Yes, I think the plan is that we can introduce those plasmids in the nursery in greenhouse plants before we plant them into the field. So then the plants that's planted into the field, they can have this viral vector to protect the plants from specific viruses.
Got it. That's really neat. That's a great idea. That's pretty cool. So that's fantastic. And the work that you're doing so far, it sounds really exciting. And it sounds like the direction that you're kind of going in the future is with leaf roll virus, which you mentioned, and then also interaction with mealybugs you mentioned. Can you tell me more about that? What's that work all about?
Because this virus, the GGVA, and other viral vectors we're working on too, a lot of viruses infecting grapevines, they are phloem-limited virus. So this GGVA is also phloem-limited, meaning that the viruses can only infect the tissues around or in the phloem. It's restricted. It doesn't go to like mesophyll cells or epidermal cells in the infected plants. Because mealybugs, they feed on phloems. So we think if they can pick up those RNA interference signals, maybe those RNA interference signals, those mRNAs can target mealybugs too. So we can choose different target sequences in mealybugs. Hopefully we can see some effects for mealybugs too, to prevent it from transmitting viruses or have lethal effects for mealybugs. That's the plan. Hopefully we can do that, but we have to do tests to see how the efficacy and everything that it can have on mealybugs. Because there are different studies. They use RNAi on insects, and many people prove that they can see some effects. We hope that the viral vector approach can also use for really apply this into the field for grapevine plants.
That was just a portion of the podcast. To listen to the full episode, visit vineyardteam.org. Stay tuned. We'll have more Ag News after the break.
Over the years, you've brought them into your home. You were prescribed opioids after the C-section and after Dad's back injury. They helped when you were in pain, and you held on to them just in case. But did you know holding on to unused opioids puts your family at risk? Trouble with opioids can start at home with unused medicines such as pills, patches, and syrups. You can remove the risk and protect your family. Find out how at www.fda.gov/drug disposal.
You've been listening to the AgNet News Hour by AgNet West. I'm your host, Danielle Leal. Welcome back. We've got more of the day's agriculture news right now.
The Organic Agronomy Training Service, known as OATS, has announced the launch of the Organic Field Crop Course. Enrollment for the course is now open, and the deadline to sign up for the summer cohort is July 31st. The course will begin on August 7th and is designed for advisors, consultants, agronomists, and agricultural professionals involved in organic field crop production. With the help of more than a dozen university researchers, extension and nonprofit educators, and industry members, OATS has developed a course that's science-based, educational, and approachable. The course is divided into 12 modules that cover pressing topics such as NOP regulations, crop rotation, weed control, soil health, marketing, and more. The course features 48 self-paced video lessons along with 6 live online sessions featuring guest speakers, Q&A, and discussion of lesson content. More information about the course is available at organicagronomy.org. I'm Brian German for AgNet West Radio Network.
Legislation introduced to improve credit for critical rural facilities. The Investing in Rural America Act was introduced in the House of Representatives, and the Farm Credit Council reacted positively. FCC President and CEO Todd Van Hoos says, quote, "We thank those who introduced the legislation for their commitment to rural communities. This legislation will spur the development of critical facilities in rural communities such as hospitals, child care centers, schools, and more." He also says the bill will facilitate partnerships between farm credit, community banks, and other lenders to provide much-needed capital to build, renovate, and modernize rural community facilities. Van Hoos adds, quote, "These kinds of facilities are critical to the viability of rural communities because they play key roles in improving the quality of life for rural families. Yet many of these communities lack the essential facilities, while other facilities need modernization." Minnesota Rep. Michelle Fishbaugh says one way Congress can support rural communities is by eliminating unnecessary barriers to capital investment. AFB contributed to that report.
To get more information on the topics you heard today, visit AgNet West online at agnetwest.com. You can also stay connected by following us on our social media, at AgNet West on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter. You can also find our broadcast team of Danielle Leal, Brian German, and Sabrina Halvertson on Facebook and Twitter. Thank you for listening to the AgNet News Hour from AgNet West. AgNet West Radio Network, your primary choice for agriculture news.